continuing to delve deeper into this treasury of the eyeball, these valley streams sounding, and these face of mountains coloring. Exploring a little bit more about these miraculous events of the natural world. So ordinary, so simple. They've been going on since the beginning of time, and yet miraculous, extraordinary at some times to some people. And we heard a story about this Zen practitioner who couldn't find the answer in his books, and so burned the books. And we heard the comment that that's a little bit like kicking your car if it doesn't start. So we have all these books. They pile up here. They're full of words. And Genzoe Soshin especially, we got these two talks a day full of words. And a lot of it is our own words of the present, but a lot of it is bringing up these old words. So in the spirit of these ancestors, let's listen to these strange Zen words without trying to figure out any answers from them, because the meaning is not in the words, and yet something hidden behind the words responds to our inquiring impulse. So let's play with words and stories some more, and without falling for them. Maybe difficult. We just heard a story about Xian Yan. Awakening when hearing a pebble striking a bamboo. And now we hear another story. One spring day. This is near the middle of page 2. One spring day, Ling Yun. His name means spiritual cloud, who would later become Zen master Jir Qin, who had been practicing for 30 years, walked into the mountains. Again, the emphasis is he didn't just walk into the mountains on some random day. This was after practicing. Practicing here is a translation of Bendo, a term that Dogen likes to use a lot, that means like wholehearted, effortful practice of the way. You could say wholehearted practice of the way for 30 years. And Ling Yun walked into the mountains. While resting, he saw peach blossoms in full bloom in a distant village and was suddenly awakened. Awakened to the way. Usually, so far, when it says awakened, it's Godo. Awake, Satori is go. He had Satori of the way, of the Tao. Satori just means like understanding or perception. In Zen, it's a kind of juicy term, right? But it's just a somewhat ordinary word in Chinese and Japanese that means like understanding. We could say awakening. Awakened to the way. So, and as many of you know, the Tao was this term in China before the Buddha Way reached China. The Tao, very ancient. We now call Taoism, Weiism, and Buddhism kind of usurped that term, that beautiful term, the Way. That's my understanding of what we call Taoism, is that the Way is often expressed as and embodied in the form of nature. Nature as it is, like, perfectly embodies and expresses the Way more clearly than complicated humans constructing their world. So in Buddhism, there's terms like marga in Sanskrit, means like the path. And so path is translated as way or Tao. And bodhi, or realization, is also sometimes translated as Tao. Since it's the point, the raison d'être of Taoism, the Tao, Buddhism said, well, let's take that up as our pinnacle of our teaching, which we have to say is Buddha's awakening, Buddhahood, enlightenment. So it has this path aspect of the path of practice, and it has the culmination as awakening or enlightenment, Tao. So I just mentioned that because Dogen uses different terms, and sometimes they just say he had great awakening, Daigo, great Satori. But it, so far in this essay, it's being put as awakened to the Way, Godo, realized the Way. And I don't know if that was intentional of Dogen to keep bringing up the Way here in these stories about nature, but it's there. So, and it's not so clear what happened if he was on this mountain and he saw this distant village and the peach blossoms were way down there, or if he was just like sightseeing around the sights of the village way out there, and suddenly in front of his face appeared a peach blossom up close. People seem to have translated it in different ways, but there's something about a distant village, or maybe this mountain is a distant village from where he normally lives. It's the mountain above a distant village from his hometown. He saw the peach blossoms in full bloom and was awakened. These stories are often told together about these waking up to natural conditions, the pebble striking the bamboo and hearing that sound and seeing the peach blossoms. He wrote this poem, which he presented to Guishan, his teacher. He's another student of Guishan. Guishan students, maybe because Guishan didn't want to tell them much about how to practice or what the Way is, as we heard in the last story. So they just had to give up and just realize the Way through sounds and colors, maybe. But it's another student of Guishan. And he wrote, "For 30 years I have looked for a sword master. Many times leaves fell, new ones sprouted. One glimpse or one seeing of peach blossoms. Now no more doubts. Just this." There's also an ancient Zen practice of when having some insight to write a poem about it. So we get all these poems celebrating their awakening to the Way. So that's the story. Simple enough. So Lin Yun, spiritual cloud. Maybe he's most known for this story of seeing peach blossoms. But there's a few other stories about Lin Yun. So later, when he was teaching, he entered the hall and addressed the assembly, saying, "Among you there are persons with various strengths and weaknesses, but you should all observe the plants and vegetation of the four seasons. The leaves falling and flowers blooming, events which have gone on for an incalculable eon." So this was his awakening, right? So he's later, years later, he's recommending this as the practice. You know, you all have different kinds of practice. Some of you have strong practice in these areas, and some have strong practices in these areas. But all of you, whatever your practice is, you should observe the four seasons with the changes of nature, the leaves falling and the flowers blooming, events which have always happened like this. The gods, humans, all realms of existence, earth, water, fire, wind, all of these things come to completion and pass away in the cycle of existence. Many Zen poems celebrate the different seasons, the impermanence of the natural world. You know, like in Japan, when it's like cherry blossom season, people freak out and go just totally wild, crying, wailing, and laughing and celebrating the falling of cherry blossoms. It's just an ordinary event that's always occurred in this world, but something about how they're so bright and fresh and they last such a short time, that may be it. Why they get so riled up about cherry blossoms. So all of these things, I was saying, earth, wind, fire, water, all these elements of the natural world come to completion and pass away in the cycle of existence. But when all of cause and effect is exhausted and all realms are finished, still throughout the universe, not a single hair will have been created or taken away. All these things coming and going, all these leaves and blossoms coming and going, arising and ceasing, and yet, still, throughout the universe, not a single hair will have been created or taken away. There remains only a fundamental, mysterious consciousness that is eternal. So, a lot could be said about such a consciousness, and is consciousness quite the right word there? Because we call the fifth skanda mind consciousness, and that also arises and ceases. But this fundamental, numinous, mysterious awareness, let's say, is eternal. And so this is the year for studying what we call Buddha nature. So today I say this is what is eternal. Buddha nature traditionally is presented as unchanging, not arising or ceasing. The Tathagata Garbha, right? The womb of the Tathagata, the heart of the Buddha. That remains as the flowers fall and leaves turn red and so on. In these few little anecdotes of Lin Yun here, they're almost all about the natural world. Another time a monk asked him, how can one escape from birth, old age, sickness, and death? That's the big question. Ling Yun said, the green mountain is fundamentally unmoving, but the floating clouds pass back and forth. The green womb of the Thus Come One mountain, fundamentally unmoving, but the floating clouds, everything we know, keep passing back and forth, dancing around the mountain. Another time, a monk asked, at the time the emperor emerges, then what? And I assume that this is a Zen metaphor for like the Buddha. The emperor was like the, almost like the god of China. Seen as kind of a beyond human kind of being. So we could say, at the time the Buddha emerges, at the time the emperor emerges, then what? And Lin Yun said, outside there's a luminous springtime. Don't ask about the capital city where the emperor lives. You could even say, at the time Buddha arrives, that crucial moment, then what? Outside, it's spring. Don't ask about that old Indian guy. Another time a monk asked, how can one gain an audience with the emperor? Lin Yun said, the blind crane dives into the clear pond. Fish scatter from its feet. Just a beautiful, dynamic image. How does a blind crane catch fish? It just dives into the clear pond, fish scattering everywhere. Thus, gaining an audience with the Buddha. And this one came up sometime in the last few months, this story about a monk asking, what's the great meaning of our Zen school? And Ling Yun said, before the donkey leaves, the horse arrives. He's the one who said that. Before this ordinary ass, this, you know, half-breed, wobbly donkey leaves, the majestic, thoroughbred horse arrives. We don't wait for the donkey to leave before the horse arrives. That's the intent of our school. There's some stories about Ling Yun, the peach blossom viewer. Now, he wrote this poem and presented it to Guishan, and Guishan said, one who enters with ripened causes will never go away. Now, I don't know where the translation ripened came from here. Causes are literally its conditions. And the character that comes before it is shou, so shouen. And this shou is like complying with or according with. And it has some other meanings, but none of them seem to be quite like ripened. So we could say, one who enters complying with conditions will never go away, or other translations are, will never backslide or regress. One who enters the way through conditions, complying with conditions, never backslides. kind of a cryptic statement, but we've been talking now some about conditions. Let's go on a little bit because there's a little more here. Dogen now says, he approved Lin Yuan in this way. And then he says, who does not enter with ripened causes? Or who does not enter according with conditions? How could you enter the way other than according with conditions? Who enters the way and backslides? How could that be so? So these are two good questions. It seems like maybe he's referring to he's entered just by according with the conditions of peach blossoms blooming, or according with the conditions of a pebble hitting a bamboo. So it's like this special thing with these natural events that's just, one awakens to these natural events by complete accord with the conditions of the moment. But Dogen points out, who enters the way not according with conditions? Other people enter the way when they hear a teacher say, drop off body and mind, or various other phrases. But still, isn't that just according with the conditions? It's according with conditions of human words. You could say it's according with the condition of the meaning behind the words, because the meaning's not in the words. Because we could say, on three, we're going to drop off body and mind. One, two, three. Drop off body and mind. But it may not happen if we're not according with the meaning behind the words. Or it may happen, and we just don't notice that it happened. Conditions are not always obvious. And it almost sounds like he's Guishan saying that this special way of entering the way by just according with conditions is so reliable that such a one never regresses or backslides in their understanding. And it's like it's Dave. There's no more doubt, no more chance to say, well, maybe that was just a funny state. And it doesn't count anymore. But Dogen points out, this is a middle way teaching. Who could enter the way except by just according with conditions? How can the way arise? How can awakening arise without conditions? And how could one regress or backslide after entering the way? Once the principle is realized, how could it be forgotten? This awakening is not limited to Lin Yuan. If mountain colors were not the unconditioned or pure body, how could this awakening have occurred? Or how could such a thing have occurred? Again, it's this word emo. How could such have occurred? This is how he inherited Dharma from Guishan. If mountain colors were not the pure body, referring back to the original story, not the pure body of Buddha, not the Dharmakaya expressed, then how could such a thing have occurred? We could say if the peach blossoms were not an expression of the true Dharma body of Buddha, the unconditioned pure body of Buddha, then how could he awaken to the way just by seeing a little petal of a flower? What's so great about that? What's so enlightening about a peach blossom. But if a peach blossom is itself the perfect expression of the Dharma body, then such a thing could occur. A note is made at some point about this 30 years of practice, and then these stories of such simple awakening on seeing a peach blossom. And the quote from the Blue Cliff Record comes up: people only like to talk about the great achievements of the present and do not ask about the sweating horses of the past. We love stories of awakening to the way and seeing peach blossoms and pebbles hitting bamboo. We love to talk about them. But we don't ask so much about the sweating horses of the past. In other words, we don't ask about this 30 years of struggle and practice that were made up part of the conditions of such a moment. Now I have another story. Once a monk asked Changsha, Zen Master Jing Shen, how do you turn mountains, rivers, and the great earth into the self? Or another translation is, how do you return mountains, rivers, and the earth into the self? There's something about the relationship between the world, that external world of nature, mountains, rivers, and great earth. We could add in, cars, trucks, and candy wrappers. How do you return all of that to oneself? How do you turn them into the self? Or how do you turn mountains, rivers, and great earth and return to the self? It's actually two different characters of turning them, literally turning them, and then returning. Or how do you unite mountains, rivers, and earth within yourself? And Changsha said, how do you turn the self into mountains, rivers, and earth? Or how do you return yourself to mountains, rivers, and earth? So we're studying mind-only teachings these days. This is a nice Zen way of expressing that. Mountains, rivers, and earth are my mind and your mind. You could say that's the self in this case. It's not really referring to ego self. It's just one self in a kind of generic way. How do we return all these mental projections and conceptual constructs that we call mountains, rivers, and earth? How do we return all that to see that it's oneself, that it's mind, that it's our mind? How do we see that all this world is our mind? How do we return this projected external world to our mind? It's not like we actually gather it in and stuff it into our brain or something, but how do we see that mountains, rivers, and the earth are ourself, are this mind? We could talk about it like that. And the teacher answers, how do you return yourself to the mountains, rivers, and earth? How do you return your mind to the mountains, rivers, and earth? He turns it another round. So, as is often the case, this is a reminds me of Dogen's Genjo Koan, of to carry the self forward and confirm the myriad things, mountains, rivers, and earth, is delusion. We could say, but mountains, rivers, and earth returning to oneself is awakening. It's just these two sides. You could say, to carry the self forward and get a hold of those mountains, rivers, and earth and bring them back to myself would be delusion. But to see how the mountains, rivers, and earth are just expressing themselves and let ourself just dissolve away into the vast expanse of mountains, rivers, and earth is awakening. Just a little similar dynamic there. We maybe can't match them up exactly, but...
Is that the same as you are not it?
Yeah. Yeah, like that, like Dungshan saying, you are not it. It actually is you. Which is, yeah, it's all very related too, because that was Dungshan's awakening when he saw the river flowing through nature and saw his reflection in the river. Like, saw himself in the river. You are not it. It actually is you. Yeah, it's another one of these two-part things. And really, it's like the whole, both working together make the whole. It's not necessarily that one's wrong and one's right. It's that there's this mutual interdependence. Like a donkey looking at its reflection in the well, and like the well looking at the donkey. And another one. Or like the flowing, the falling flowers consciously, intentionally follow the flowing stream. And the flowing stream mindlessly carries the falling flowers. There's one event, but then there's just two ways of looking at it. Dogen then says, saying that the self returns to the self is not contradicted by saying that the self is mountains, rivers, and the great earth. So this is a dynamic sentence in Japanese, it looks like. Another translation is, saying that the self returns to the self, even if the self is mountains, rivers, and great earth, do not hinder what is returned. Do not hinder what is returned. Saying that the self returns to the self, or we could say mind returns to mind, even if this mind is mountains, rivers, and great earth, do not hinder those things that are returned to mind. You can see it that way. Seeing that mind is just mind, even if mind is manifested as mountains, rivers, and earth, don't hinder that those mountains, rivers, and earth by making them into more or less than they are, making them into substantially external things. Okay, let's do another story. We're moving through the stories here because they're short ones. And they're all bringing out different dimensions of our relationship to nature, mind and nature, the interdependence and conditionality of nature and mind. Lan Ya Hui Jue, great master Guang Zhao, was a Dharma descendant of Nan Yue. Once Jir Xuan, a lecturer on the scriptures, asked Lan Ya, if originally unconditioned, or again, literally it's pure, it doesn't really say unconditioned, pure, Vixaikaz and or Catherine, said, well, people might not know what pure means in the Zen context, so doesn't it mean unconditioned? So I would say that's a nice way to put it. But it might have more dimensions than unconditioned, too. If originally pure or unconditioned, how do mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly emerge or arise? And this is a saying from the Sharangama Sutra, the Heroic March Sutra. If originally pure, if there's just originally unconditioned suchness, how do these things, like mountains, rivers, and earth, suddenly arise? Or if mind is just... if everything is just mind, and the nature of mind is just luminous emptiness, how does mountains, rivers, and earth emerge from this luminous emptiness of mind from a mind-only perspective? And Lan Ya responded, if originally unconditioned, how do mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly emerge? So he just repeats it back.
So yesterday on the first page, within like two paragraphs, the poem refers to the mountains as the unconditioned body, mm-hmm. and then a little bit, like a couple sentences later, they talk about the manifested Buddha body.
Yeah.
I was wondering if those bodies are separate, and I was also wondering how anything could be unconditioned.
Yeah, well, as I say, literally it doesn't say that. In all those cases where it says unconditioned, it says pure, pure, two characters that both mean pure, literally like the English word, like free of dust and dirt. So how can anything be unconditioned? No thing can. Things are by definition conditioned. So, but the Dharmakaya is not a thing. And the Dharmakaya is said to be unconditioned. In other words, it doesn't depend on conditions. It's kind of a big topic because we also have this word uncompounded. And I've been having these discussions with my teacher, Tenzin Roshi, in the last couple of months about this, kind of around this point. Is there a difference between uncompounded and unconditioned? That's a kind of question that's interesting to me these days. We have this word asamskrita in Sanskrit. That samskrita is actually the same word as Sanskrit. And Sanskrit is the name of the Indian language, and it means like to construct, because that's what language constructs the world. So Sanskrit, it's the name of a language, but it also means to construct, literally. And so samskrita is an important Buddhist term that means like constructed things. And asamskrita means unconstructed or uncompounded things, means like things. According to Abhidharma, dharmas, a thing is a translation of dharma. So there are these asamskrita dharmas, meaning like uncompounded things. Maybe thing is kind of stretching it in this case. Phenomena, though, uncompounded phenomena, there are on the list of Abhidharma dharmas, Abhidharma phenomena, and such as cessation, like nirvana is uncompounded, and space is uncompounded. But I wouldn't say that space is unconditioned. Now, some people might. This is where it gets tricky. Because that word asamskrita in English is translated by many translators as uncompounded or unconstructed, and by many other translators as unconditioned. And my teacher feels that actually there's a big difference between saying unconditioned and uncompounded. Because like space, you could say, it's not compound, it's not empty, completely empty space, not like air, which has molecules, but a vacuum, but like a physical vacuum, space, like outer space, is not made up of anything, so it's not compounded, constructed, but we could say it is conditioned, and the point that my teacher's making is that it depends on, it's conditioned by, or depends on, us, mind, actually, right? Like there's no space without mind to attribute spaceness to it. I mean, this is, again, coming from a mind-only perspective, that space actually depends on mind. We could, and depends and conditioned by, I would say, our synonyms. So, it looks like we can have uncompounded things like space, barely a thing, but a phenomena, and cessation also. It's not really like a thing exactly, but it's listed as a phenomena. But that those are not actually unconditioned. Now, we could say though, we could go one step beyond space and like meditative cessations, and say that the Dharmakaya, the Dharma body of the Buddha, is not compounded and it's also unconditioned. And this is where I've been having these kind of debates with Tenzin Roshi. Right? Because some teachers would say that actually the Dharmakaya, the Dharma body of the Buddha, does not depend on our mind, actually. It's that... it's actually unconditioned, independent of our mind, even. Yes?
So you're saying the Dharmakaya and the Buddha, what do you want?
The body? Yeah, the Dharma body of the Buddha. Same thing, yeah. Yeah, Kaya means body.
Is that where all the phenomena arise from? Or is that separate?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, we could hear this question as, you know, purity is originally so, how does all these phenomena arise from that? We could say that purity is the Dharma body, and all the phenomena arise from it.
Like, I'm trying to, like, is it that it's arising from it, or that it's arising separate from it?
Yeah. I think
out of that sort of like silent
ground. Well, there's a lot that could be said here, right? And I think some of this territory we might go into in this class series that's coming up on the Lankavatara Sutra. But the Dharma, for now, let's say the Dharma body of the Buddha is like when the Buddha nature, so we have this term Buddha nature that's also like, people might say unconditioned there. I'll say for now that Buddha nature is unconditioned. In other words, it doesn't depend on certain conditions to be Buddha nature.
Like it's always
Buddha nature. It's never begun, it never ceases. Well, that's what I just wanted to say now, that there's a little difference. I'm going to make this distinction between Buddha nature and Dharmakaya, just that Buddha nature is like the nature that we all have as sentient beings, that doesn't arise and cease and is pure of all duality and conceptual constructions and everything. And it is actually what, when it's free of all the, layers of concealment, you could say, all the obscurations that, obscure it, then it's called the Dharmakaya. So it's a little bit different that, you know, it's not separate from the Dharmakaya. In nature, it's exactly the same as the Dharma, as the Buddha's Dharma body. The Buddha nature is exactly the same as the Buddha's Dharma body. But when we talk about Buddha nature, we sometimes say that it's like, it's still, to say it's the nature that all beings have, it's still in this like, it's obscured, or it's like, it's mixed with, it's like pure water mixed with sediment. And so it's kind of like muddy. And when the pure Dharmakaya is like all the sediments all settled to the bottom. So when you say, do all things come from the Dharmakaya, I would maybe bring it back and say, we could say that all things manifest from or as expressions of Buddha nature of all beings, like our Buddha nature right now that's mixed with the kind of mud of our like confusions and stuff, that Buddha nature can manifest as mountains and rivers and earth. But that the Dharma body.
So everything in the physical plane is Buddha nature. Is that what you mean when you say it can manifest as the
mind? Well, that's a little extra step to say that all physical things have Buddha nature. It's like, it's a little different to say all the so-called physical world manifests as an expression of Buddha nature. It's a little bit different than saying all those things have Buddha nature. But this is another dynamic topic that to explore is, do non-sentient things have Buddha nature? That's a big one that we'll have to look at some point.
So is it like that you could think of Buddha nature as like the most subtle form of your mind, like, and that is what is creating
other
objects that have Buddha nature but they're not sentient beings?
You could say the most subtle form of our mind, or you could say it's like the true nature of our mind, which is most subtle.
So is the Buddha nature what experiences the silence that's behind the Dharmakaya? You know what I mean? Like, if there's an awareness of Dharmakaya, then is it Buddha nature that's having the awareness?
We could also say Buddha nature is the awareness. It's not so much that Buddha nature has the awareness. Buddha nature actually is awareness. And it's not so much that Buddha nature is the awareness of the Dharmakaya. It's more that Buddha nature is just is the same nature as the Dharmakaya, is also this pure awareness. It's just that when we talk about it, it's like the fully manifested and revealed Buddha nature is called the Dharmakaya. But before it's fully manifested and revealed, it's called Buddha nature. Or this other term, Tathagata Garbha, like the womb of the Tathagata, which has that kind of image of like, it's still in embryonic form. You know, it hasn't been born as Dharmakaya yet. No, so yeah, that's right. As a metaphor, that's why Garbha is a little bit, to translate Garbha as womb, has that problem. Because yeah, Dharmakaya is unborn. That's what it is. It's the unborn. So, but still, these are things that are, the meaning is not in the words, right? These are things that are hard to talk about. So the tradition came up with this term, Tathagata Garbha, and Garbha in Sanskrit is also this very dynamic term that can mean womb, and it can also mean like heart. And so, like the heart essence of the Tathagata or the Buddha. So some practitioners and scholars like to say womb is really off for some of the reasons that you mentioned. Like, that kind of sounds like it's a potential that then becomes something or is born as something, where in fact Tathagatagarbha doesn't change by definition. It's
the same as Dhammakaya,
or the same as the Buddha? I think we can say Tathagatagarbha and Buddha nature are synonyms. And sometimes Dharmakaya gets brought in there as a synonym too, but I think maybe more helpful and maybe more often it's presented as, it's not different in nature, but it's different, kind of different in the sense that it's the full culmination, whereas Buddha nature or Tathagatagarbha is still, when we use those terms, it means like in its obscured, it's mixed with a sentient being. It's obscured by a sentient being, in the form of being mixed with a sentient being, which is sentient beings can be like also gross consciousness. Like, we're sentient beings, right? So everything we're thinking, we're like trying to figure out Tathagatagarbha and Buddha nature and these, like, we're thinking in these dualistic constructs. We're trying to get a picture of it and get a hold of it. Like, all that stuff is like the sentient being. So sentient beings can get into pretty subtle consciousness. We have, sentient beings have consciousness.
So it's not just referring to
when Buddha nature is defined. Sentient being. Yeah, almost like they're almost like not exactly opposite. Again, there's a really dynamic relationship between sentient beings and Buddha nature. These days, the way I understand it is, and again, this Lankavatara Sutra gets into this in some very interesting ways, but it's like, I see it as like, a sentient being is kind of like this storehouse consciousness, we call it, right? This where a sentient being is the sum total of everything that's ever happened to them, all their experience, but it's all obscured. Like, all the experience, you say all the experience, it's the sum total of all our experiences, but virtually all our experiences, virtually, or all, let's say for now, virtually all experiences we've ever had are obscured. Even the greatest ones and the clearest ones, they're still subtly dualistic. There's still this sense of internal and external, of mind and environment and so on. So all of that that we call the storehouse consciousness, we could call that a sentient being. And that's like, it's kind of like muddy. It's kind of like all the experiences are like little particles of sediment, but those particles of sediment are completely mixed into this pure, totally clear water that we could call Tathagatagarbha or Buddha nature. So they're like completely interfused, but we can talk about them as completely separate. So like so muddy water, is the mud and the water like two separate things? Or are they one thing called muddy water? It's that kind of relationship, as I would understand it. And we're talking about a sentient being and Buddha nature. They're not exactly identical, but they're completely mixed. But the story, the traditional story, is that through practice, eventually there's this settling of all that sediment of the sentient being. I could say the sentient being settles out on the bottom. And actually, the most extreme form of this that some people find obnoxious is to say that in order for Buddha nature to come to its fruition as the Dharmakaya, as its fruition, the sentient being must be removed. People don't like that one. Yes.
Embraces or sustains or manifests or fulfills all conditions.
Yeah, it is. We could even say free from conditions is kind of like saying unconditioned. I think those would be like the same. But maybe you're implying free from conditions means like there's conditions floating around, but it's free of them without getting rid of them. Is that what you're kind of?
It's kind of like all conditions are included.
Yeah.
As opposed to like there's conditions.
Yeah.
That's free of conditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I think these stories are starting to point to, actually. Purity is originally so. Unconditioned purity is originally so. How does it produce all these conditioned things like mountains and rivers and so on? So,
couldn't we even say that the mountains and rivers are unconditioned? If you think about, let's say, if human beings died off or exterminated themselves, what remains composed of condition?
Yeah, and well, are there mountains, rivers, and earth if there's no sentient beings? That's the mind only question. Does a tree make a sound in the forest when no one's there to hear it? This is another big one that's also really hard to deal with. If we say, actually, no, if there's no sentient beings to create a world, then there's no world. So at the moment that the last, it doesn't have to be humans, but any sentient being with a mind, once the last one goes, there's no more world. That might sound weird, kind of like science fiction or something, but if you hear it from a kind of mind-only perspective, it's pretty radical, but that's my current understanding, is that this world... Now, there's another thing, and this is another ongoing conversation I'm having with my teacher about... who agrees that there's no world apart from sentient beings. But he would say, could there be something that's not a world, even when there's no sentient beings?
An asteroid?
No, that's, you know, no, I mean, that's a human, we create asteroids.
No, but let's say we don't exist anymore.
Yeah. I don't think so. I mean, according to mind only, something floating around out there, and that's where actually mind only. I often reach my limits when kind of contemplating mind only stuff. When I look around at all this stuff, and yeah, okay, I'm creating the Zendo. Definitely, you know, the Zendo. We're really creating because, you know, we're Zen people. We created the Zendo. But even like trees and mountains, okay, I can warm up the trees and mountains. But when I look at the stars, you know, outside this planet, that we're creating them, that there's no external world apart from mind, that's where it gets really, my resistance comes up fully, and asteroids and stuff. But again, that would be my understanding, that there aren't those things apart from mind. But then there's this question, is there, because those are part of, the world doesn't mean like planet Earth, right? The world we're talking about means anything we can possibly think of in the universe. We can call it the universe, is created by mind.
Or you could say that the universe itself is sentient.
Yeah. And is there something other than a universe if there's no sentient beings? And that's, and of course, if there was, it's completely unimaginable. but maybe we don't say nothing at all. Yeah.
But that's so human centric.
Well,
there
yeah.
There could be many sentient beings on other.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's true.
And
yes.
So why limit it to? So if we go poop.
Yeah, yeah.
The other sentient beings
yeah.
that continue to perceive the universe.
Good point. Yeah, according to this story, that counts. Yeah. It definitely doesn't have to be humans, and it doesn't have to be sentient beings on this planet, but we'd have to say there's no more sentient beings in the universe or in any multiverse to project a universe or a multiverse. And you could even say, well, if there's sentient beings on another planet, like 10 million light years from here, who never heard about Earth, and it's way out of their vision, and, you know, then maybe there's not an earth. It's like they have to create the earth. They'd have to recreate it. Just like those beings on other planets, or those other planets 1,000 light years from here that we don't know about, aren't there for us unless we create them. And are they there for those other beings? Well, it's really dynamic too, because those other beings even aren't there except for us. So you could say it's human-centric, but we're not really saying just humans, but you could say it's sentient-centric. And it is. Sentient-centric, maybe another translation for mind only. Yes?
Not exist if we didn't keep creating each other.
Like
we co-create each other.
And it's, you know, we can see this in little ways. That's a great example of like contemplating mind only. That right, like right now we're co-creating each other. Like we're really like in the moment. You know, you are my version of you, and I am your version of me, and we're like completely interdependent. And it's not like, well, there's a real you that I just don't know. It's like, it's not really like that. There's no fixed any of us. We're literally co-creating each other all the time. Yeah, but they do that. Yeah, it's inevitable. I mean, every moment we're recreating everybody. But yeah, we notice it in certain... If somebody changes in some big way, it's hard for us because that's a thing, part of this mind-only thing, is that we like stable versions of things. And you could say that's why we create a pretty stable world. You could say the world's not that stable. There's a lot of stuff kind of going weird in the world. But you could say we're creating that too. We kind of like to do that too. We don't like it too stable, but we like it pretty stable. So we like to, when we come back in the Zendo tomorrow, we like the room to look basically the same. We like that. It's good for our settling into calm Zazen. If we came in, if we opened the door and it was like an African jungle and there were like, you know, lions roaring at the door, we had to shut the door, we'd be like, I can't concentrate like this. But in fact, it is kind of more like that. Yeah.
For clarification, did you say that mind-only was not egocentric?
Not egocentric.
Sure,
egocentric. We haven't brought in the word ego yet, exactly.
Well, that we create everything just sounds that way to me.
We could say ego is a big part of mind only, but it's not the whole story. You could say, in terms of the Yogacara mind only story, there's these seven consciousnesses, and the seven consciousness we could call ego. But then there's these other consciousnesses that that aren't really ego, but they're just like, they're just dependent, arising mind. It doesn't have like, it's just stuff is happening, you know. So it's not like we sit here and like, I'm going to create the Zendo now. Ready? It's like, that would be kind of egocentric, creating the Zendo. We can't really do it. Or let's change it into an African rainforest now. Come on! It's like it doesn't work because there's other stuff besides just ego.
Well, if you say, if we look at the universe, if we look at the stars, and if I don't exist, they don't exist, that doesn't make sense to me.
That's why there's not so many people in the world taking up the view of mind only. It doesn't make sense to most people, but But it might be interesting to like really explore deeply the possibilities of, could it be so? And it's not just mine only. There's actually some Western philosophers that propose the same view through their own experience. And I think what's interesting about mine only, it's not just like a strange philosophy that people came up with. I think it came from people's experience of like, well, like, you know, the most basic kind of coarse examples, and you could say, well, this doesn't go that far, but the ones that we can really relate to are the ones about, you know, like, to a dog, this is not a book. So we, in our unique human consciousness, are creating a book out of something here, and a dog would see it as, you know, something to lie on or whatever. Right, or something to eat. So they really don't see it, and this is just a common everyday example, right? It's not a book for them. Now we say, well, that's easy enough, but that's not saying that it's just created by mind. But we could actually say that this, you know, this being a book, and we really think it's a book. We don't think it's food. But a termite or a dog might really think that it's food. So they really do see it differently. Their mind creates a different object here. And that's not so hard to see. But you just keep applying that, investigating that principle and taking it further and further to say that, you know, I think the problem comes in here where it gets difficult is when we say, there really is an object out here. And people see it as a book, and termites see it as food, but there really is some object that's, you know, experienced differently. And, but mine only gets into, like, well, then what is that object? Is it really a book, or is it really food? Or is it...
Isn't that like, grass is the lawn to me, but to a cow it's food?
Yeah, like that.
So when it has a specific purpose, it has meaning.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't have a purpose to you, it still has meaning.
Yeah, and so this is like really basic. This is kind of like warm-up mind-only teachings, but it's worth like really, really like investigating that to where we're totally convinced that like if we try to imagine being a termite, which we can't, right? Because we still see it through our human termite eyes. It's a book to eat. It's not a book to eat for a termite, right? But where it gets even trickier is like, it's not an object, you know? It's like the mind only thing is saying, it's not like there's some objective thing that we're projecting different stories onto. It's saying the very fact that it's objective, that it's an object apart from mind, that's a story. That's a sentient being story that even probably termites do too. They see it as, food is not like, they're not eating themselves, right? They're eating a food out there. They're looking for food out there. So that's where it gets harder. Just it takes more contemplation to see how we're actually creating an external world. Another great example, just, I don't know how we got off in this mind-only tangent, right? I do know how it got up. Mind did it. But anyway, just another like warm-up one that's maybe a little more stronger, I think, than termites and humans is I've been thinking about. So the visual world. So we see this zendo, right? We see this room. But science would tell us that actually there's an image on the back of our retina, right? And it's actually upside down. I mean, scientists say this. We don't have to believe them, but they say that there's these rods and cones that receive color, and there's millions of them, right? And they're receiving a bunch of different colors, and then we have this like, you know, stereoscopic vision thing, right? Of like three-dimensional world. We know just, you know, it seems like it's there, but it's really two different images on the back of retinas, and then visual consciousness, according to Buddhism, you know, puts these two together and it flips it right side up so that we don't fall over. It flips the image around. You probably heard about these things. And that's what we're seeing. We're not really seeing like this book. We're seeing like we're just talking about visual consciousness, right? We're seeing like colors on the back of the eyeball. I mean, technically speaking, according to science, we're not seeing this book, right? So that's another, again, it's not this is just a little warm-up thing, but it's not the full extent of the mind-only story, but to really contemplate that, and now what we say, again, it's this problem of the object. So the scientists would say, well, there really is an objective Zendo out here, even though we don't see it. We see the stuff back here in the eyeball, but there is an object that that creates these light rays that appear on the back of the eyeball. And mind only saying, well, are you so sure? Yes.
So, if you have an experience of that everything is seamless, you know, and it's all one sort of like energetic field, then what?
Wasn't that one of the questions here? Then what? If you're having that experience, you could further investigate.
What if the experience comes and goes? Mm-hmm. You have it and then solidify and go back to the
Probably so, right? Because if it stayed like that, then you probably wouldn't be able to get out of the Zendo. Right? You'd just be like, it's all, there's, the door is no different than the floor, and the wall is no different from this. Yeah. So, but it might be that, the thing is, like, you know, I'd say you could investigate at such a time, but actually, at such a time seemed like the, investigating faculty of the mind is kind of not, it's kind of not operating so strongly. It's kind of like, because that one's usually thinking in terms of subjects and objects and asking questions like this, so it's kind of like, it's just openness. So, you know, to ask any questions, investigate anything at that time might just like destroy such a vision, you know. But you could, I don't know, maybe afterwards. I mean, or you could try during, if the thought arises during, not exactly even a thought, but just like a question in a wordless question of like, from a mind-only investigation might be like, is this seamless whole that's happening right now, is this mind or is this external to mind? We could ask such a question. Sometimes we think, like the whole world is this one. Might be a little bit different than saying the whole world is just mind. Or they might be the same that we could check out. And by our answer, we might fall into different philosophical schools within Buddhism or other spiritual traditions. Yes?
The seeds that we water are the ones that are going to grow. So the African jungle is not that much more unlikely than a Japanese medieval jungle.
Yeah, this is a pretty weird space we created here, isn't it? Yeah. Certain people from Santa Cruz might just, you know, walk in off the street and be like, did I just enter medieval Japan? Yeah. Like that, you mean? Yeah. And it wasn't that hard to create this. I mean, we managed to do it somehow. So, yeah, because of the seeds we planted, exactly. So if we have enough, if we you know, contemplating African rainforests or spend enough time there or something, then eventually this Zendo might become an African rainforest. And I was thinking, like, things about like, the stars and planets and stuff. It's like, are we creating them? It's like, well, we have certain seeds, the story would go, to create stars and planets. And we create them in similar ways. That's another doubt that comes up around these things is, well, why do we all see things so similar if we're all creating it self, like if it's like a, it's not a kind of egocentric in terms of like, there's only me in the universe and this is my world, you all are illusory objects of my world. That, it's not quite like that. It's more like we're all co-creating the world in an almost inconceivable way due to like collective karmic seeds for, you know, we share, like humans, see, you know, have similar karmic conditions to see this as a book, but, and we share certain things with termites, like seeing it as objective is really universal, seeing it as external to mind, but termites as a species have like different seeds, different storehouse seeds for seeing large rectangular yummy paper things. So all this comes from purity is originally so. The nature of mind, we could say, is originally just such. Buddha nature doesn't come and go, and there's nothing, no thing there in Buddha nature. So how do mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly arise? How are they suddenly born? This happens to be the 100th case in the Book of Serenity, Lanya's Mountains and Rivers. Purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountain rivers in the great earth? So, in the fourth part of the Sharangama Sutra, the Heroic March Sutra, Purana, some Bodhisattva asks, and this is kind of a mind-only thing here, This makes the connection to what we've been talking about, it seems to me. See if you think so. If all the faculties and sense data, so all the sense faculties, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, and all the data, like colors, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, mind objects, and the skandhas, the aggregates of body and mind, all mental experiences, and all the consciousnesses, if they are all these are Chittagata Garbha, the heart of the Buddha, Buddha nature, pure in its original state, why does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, earth, and all compounded, constructed characteristics which gradually change and flux and then begin again? That's the question in the sutra. It's also making the point that all these consciousnesses and all the way the mind works is all the Tathagata Garbha, which is a thing that's going to come out in this Lankavatara Sutra too, that this, usually they're not equated. Buddha nature is perfectly pure and mixed with all these dualistic consciousnesses. Even the storehouse consciousness is dualistic. But this sutra and the Lankavatara say these things really are Tathagata Garbha, these consciousnesses, which is a kind of getting towards Patrice's question too, like, are we making a distinction here between this pure, unconditioned realm and dualistic consciousness and its objects? So, but if all these consciousnesses that create things and so on are all really this pure, original Tathagata Garbha Buddha nature that doesn't come and go, why did all these coming and going things arise from it? And the Buddha, I think, says, if you understand, you already know the essence of enlightenment is fundamentally immaculate. Ignorance is fundamentally empty. The mountains, rivers, and earth are like features of flowers in the sky. If you're deluded, subject and object are falsely distinguished. powerful awareness suddenly appears, and the three subtleties make the world, like basically dualistic projections and so on, make the world. Mind makes the world. The four spheres, like the elements, make the elemental realm. So this is in this Sharangama Sutra. Enlightenment, awakened mind, Dharmakaya, is fundamentally immaculate, pure, but ignorance and all these dualistic consciousnesses and objects are actually empty. And therefore, these objects that we think of as objects, like mountains, rivers, and earth, are features of flowers in the sky. Flowers in the sky is that Indian image of when you have cataracts and you see, like, there's it's like you see flowers in front of your eyes, but that they're not really there. They're like illusory flowers that are just like a visual defect. So that's flowers in the sky. Cataracts. And people even translate it as you see cataract visions. Yeah. Mountains, rivers, and earth are like that. If you're deluded, subject and object are falsely distinguished or separated. But awareness appears and mind makes the world. And then Lanya says, referring to this sutra, if purity is originally so, how does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and earth? When asked that same question, he responds with the same question. And then the verse celebrating this story by the collector, Tian Tong, says, seeing existence without considering it existent, turning the hand over and back, the person on Mount Lanya does not fall behind Gotama, the Buddha. So seeing existence without considering it existent, turning the hand over and back, there's a side was originally pure, nothing arises and ceases, and then the other side is the great earth and all the mountains and rivers arising. And then it quotes Nagarjuna, saying a classic Nagarjunian statement that that gets to the heart of some of these questions, I think, in a really concise way. He says, all things must exist because of conditions. All things must not exist because of conditions. And the commentator says, this is turning the hand over and back. So if you've heard Nagarjuna, it's like dependent co-arising, right, is this realm. Dependent on other conditions, a world arises, or mountains, rivers, and earth arise. Arise means arise, children. And be a world. Mountains, rivers, and earth arise means, like, that's not nothing arising, no ceasing. They arise, dependent on conditions. Things arise, dependent on conditions, no thing arises. And that's the special treat of Nagarjuna, right? Because the book depends on conditions like my eye seeing it, to be or my mind thinking it's a book, depends on that. Because it depends on conditions, it doesn't arise. Ultimately, it's not a book. So that's the beauty of dependent co-arising, and a very nice way to say it is, depending on conditions, everything arises and ceases. There's an impermanent world arising and ceasing, appearing to arise and cease, and at the same time, the other side of the hand is, depending on conditions, no thing arises because there's no thing apart from conditions. So that's the, so purity is originally so, nothing arises in that purity. How can it give rise to mountains, rivers, and earth? So from one side, nothing ever arises. How the world, there is no world. Ultimately speaking, there's no world. From the other side, it's like the world arises depending on conditions. And from the mind-only point of view, we say the main condition that the world depends on is mind. That's where, you know, that's where mind, the Yogacara's teachings build on Nagarjuna and single out this one great condition that they sometimes call the storehouse consciousness of everything. It is almost like a creator of the world. So, a bunch more sky flowers. But may these seeds of this discussion, and it's not like, you know, nothing's definitive here. Remember from the beginning, we're just playing with words here. These are all just human constructs. We're creating this whole strange vision of a universe created by, you know, mind, and again, mind is not really like ourself. It's bigger than that. It's mind is not a thing, and it's not limited to me and you. But may all these complicated, confusing or illuminating words settle down into the ground of the storehouse consciousness as we sit for the rest of the day. And see how they, without trying to squeeze the juice out of them or something, just let it all percolate around. May a beautiful, compassionate, awakened, free, and dancing world be created now and forever by our mind for the benefit of all the beings created by mind. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gate boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.